the track here? Okay, great. Hope everybody found a desirable plate of food, and for sure keep enjoying your lunch while we go through our lunch and keynote speaker, I'll call it, which is we're thrilled at TD to be hosting Rogers Communications on stage now. Obviously, the largest wireless player in Canada and one of the leading overall telecom players. So we have two distinguished speakers from Rogers today. One I'm sure is no stranger to anybody in this room is Tony Staffieri, the Chief Financial Officer. And then to my far left, George Fernandez, Chief Technology Officer at Rogers. So Tony and George, thank you very much for being here and for your time today.
Well, thank you for having us, and good afternoon, everyone.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Let me start off with wireless and just the market and subscriber environment. So Rogers had a particularly strong 2018 with 453,000 postpaid sub adds, but obviously took a big step back in Q1. What are your perspectives, Tony, on the market activity going on? Was there some sort of just temporary lull in the market, or do you think that all of 2019 we should expect that sort of deceleration in growth?
Yeah, we continue to see, I'll get to the punchline. We continue to see good, healthy growth. You know, if you look at Q1, as we've said in the past, relatively slow quarter traditionally, and even more so this Q1, when you're trying to look at it on a year-on-year basis. Less promotional activity. 2017 had the overhang of the Q4 intensity that spilled over into Q1. Which was a big factor for our net add performance the year before. But if you step back from that and, think about levels of competitive intensity, timing of iconic devices as just some things that, slowed the market down, we continue to look at some of the more important fundamentals. Penetration in Canada still continues to be 89% or so, compared to the U.S., which continues to grow and sitting at about 125%. So we kind of look at that as a pretty significant fundamental that will give us headroom for continued growth. Immigration is another one that we've said it continues to have very good growth rates in Canada, generally in the 2-3% range, particularly in urban areas. And so that's another underlying fundamental that we see. And then when you think about all the other things in terms of second devices, et cetera, all the core ingredients that led to the good growth in 2018, we think are still there. And so if you look at 2018, growth rate of somewhere around 5.5%, give or take a bit, depending on what adjustments different folks are making to it, still see 2019 growth rates somewhere in the 4.5-5% rate. So slightly below 2018, but in the overall context, still very, very healthy growth. But the second part of it is, to what extent do we want to participate, we Rogers, in terms of promotional activity and share? And you saw us pull back a little bit in Q1, and I would say that was us being very conscientious about doing that from the outset in Q1 as we stayed focused on price discipline and our ARPU agenda. At the end of the day, we're really pleased with our revenue share performance, leading the industry on revenue share, leading the industry on share of EBITDA growth, when you take out the effect of lease accounting, which impacted all of us to varying degrees. So we're kind of pleased of our ability to stay focused on those fundamentals, and you'll see that throughout the rest of the year. As we head into Q2, I think we're seeing the market generally, we're kind of midway through Q2, still being somewhat sluggish, maybe a bit of an uptick. And we're seeing our share performance trending better than what we would have seen in Q1. So kind of pleased with the way it's playing out overall, but generally on track to the type of growth rates that I talked about for the full year.
Which I guess implies that there's the big seasonal periods of the year, like back to school and Black Friday and Christmas season. If you're going to be close to last year in terms of overall industry growth, maybe it just has to be more concentrated in those periods of time. I think that's what Joe has maybe indicated. I'm wondering if that's still what you're thinking.
And that's still our thinking. We've said more and more, we've trained consumers to focus on key promotional periods. And as the market just frankly gets more efficient in doing that, what we're seeing is those periods that you mentioned, back to school, Black Friday, Christmas, is kind of being the key periods that consumers are now willing to wait for. And so I think that probably means a little more heightened activity in and around those periods this year. And it's a trend we've seen over the last 3 to 4 years, frankly.
Okay. Now, the other key ingredient to the, you know, sort of revenue growth beyond the subscribers is the ARPU or ABPU. You still had the best growth of out of the incumbents at 0.8% in the first quarter in terms of ARPU, but it was a pretty big pullback from 2% that we saw in the back half of last year. If promotional activity eased off in Q1, and we may have seen some selective rate increases on some plans, can you talk about, you know, is that 0.8 going to continue to trend down, or do you think you can see a recovery as the year goes on?
Overall, we continue to see good prospects for ARPU growth in the rest of the year. I would probably describe Q1 as being our low point in terms of ARPU growth. If we look to the key ingredients on the ARPU side, huge opportunity for continued data consumption continuing to go up. When we look at our average data per user, you know, we'd sit at about 2.5, whereas the U.S. Players' average consumption would be over 8 and approaching 8.5. And so much like the penetration correlation that we see, we think about it the same way in terms of consumption. And so that still has a lot of headroom in terms of growth in the Canadian industry. And so lots of upside for customers to continue to move up in data buckets. Saw a bit of a slowdown again around Q4 and Q1 in terms of that migration. Some of the data promotion buckets that were in market caused that slowdown. But as consumption, which is growing, continues to grow at 30 to 50% rates, continues to push consumers back up towards the top end of their data buckets, we think in the second half of the year what you'll see is more of that migration to higher tier buckets. And it's important to highlight it's not so much on the gross ad side, but more so in the base and getting those customers to get into a new device or get those customers into a better plan that's more suitable for their data usage. And that's an area we've gotten a lot better at. You know, we refer to it as base management, but it really is the analytics, incorporating all the tools, and the tools have gotten much more sophisticated with AI and a number of other things that allow us to proactively reach out to customers, but also in a reactive setting, do a much better job of giving the customer value in moving up in the data buckets and continuing to convert overage revenue into more of a recurring right-sized plan for that customer.
Good. Let's bring George in here and leverage your expertise. Obviously, I think the investment community was a little surprised at how the 600 megahertz auction shook out, both in terms of Rogers getting so much and one unnamed player not getting any. Can you talk about the power of 600, how you see it benefiting your network going forward? And I'll add that you're adding that to a position of low-band spectrum that was already ahead of any of your peers in Canada, so now you have a wealth of the stuff. What are your views on what you can do with that spectrum going forward?
Well, we see all networks, whether it's 3G, 4G, 5G, requiring multiple levels of spectrum. And the spectrum serves different purposes depending on the quality or the kind of spectrum that you have. And we have a good position on low-band spectrum that is currently being used for 3G and 4G. And so that is spectrum that is very useful, and we see every day devices still using roughly total 10% of total data still going through the low bands. And the reason is because low band provides just that contiguous quality layer of coverage of the network. And so when we went into the 600 auction, obviously we had done a lot of planning, a lot of thinking up front. Just to give you an idea, we think about these auctions at least a year in advance. So there's a lot of planning, a lot of thinking, a lot of game theory, you know, the various possibilities and outcomes. And so we were very happy with the outcome. Frankly, weren't expecting to get as much as we did, certainly in southern Ontario, where we got the full 40 megahertz that were available. But going forward, this is incredibly important for us because as we think towards 5G, 5G will have essentially three layers of spectrum. There's a sort of the low band, which obviously 600 will be the spectrum for low band. And that will provide a number of roles. One is the obvious wide area coverage that will provide that contiguous level of coverage of the network. And we'll be able to, from a Rogers point of view, given the existing 700 spectrum that we have already and the radios that we have out there, quickly switch on 5G across our network without a significant investment. It's also very useful for indoor penetration. Those areas where you know, the base station has the power to penetrate through, but your device needs to get back, 600 is a great spectrum for providing also that uplink connection. The mid-band will be important as we obviously as we go forward to provide those capacity requirements in hotspots in urban areas. And then, obviously, the millimeter wave is a sort of the third type of spectrum that we will use for very, you know, high capacity, very dense areas. Canada, you know, is a very large country, and you know, it has a very low sort of population density. So, if, you know, obviously, the 600 spectrum in a country like Canada, you know, takes on even a greater importance, if you will. And obviously that was taken into consideration as well when we thought about our acquisition strategy.
Are there certain, not even rural markets, but even just smaller urban markets and suburban markets where Rogers may have a bit of a head start because you can use low band for 5G, whereas the others are going to need to put in smaller cell sites to use higher band spectrum, so there could be a bit of a time to market advantage in some of those outside of not necessarily downtown Toronto, but some of the smaller markets?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the great thing about having 40 megahertz is now all of a sudden it's not just a coverage play for us. We can actually think about low band in capacity terms as well, which gives us the additional confidence to go into some of these lower population areas and provide not just the coverage, but also the capacity as well. So that will absolutely be an advantage for us.
And Rogers put out a press release earlier this week about a new narrowband Internet of Things technology that you're deploying in mm-hmm. Ontario in 2019.
Yeah.
Is that something that leverages the low-band spectrum for asset management and other IoT applications?
Narrowband IoT is what I would consider one of the other tools that we have in our toolbox. It's using the 700 megahertz spectrum. Narrowband IoT uses a very low bandwidth, so roughly around 200 kilobits per second. And it's there for stationary asset tracking sensors and devices. So essentially those devices that provide have a very low bandwidth requirement but very low power, so it goes very, very deep into the network. And also very low power utilization, which means as we think about battery utilization, you know, you can have devices out there for many years without the need to maintain. So narrowband IoT is a great technology for that. And as we think forward, it will continue to evolve with 5G as well into other more sophisticated, more evolved use cases.
Great. Tony, maybe for you to just stick on 5G for a sec in terms of the revenue opportunities. Do you have any updated thoughts of how Rogers thinks about 5G, how quickly we'll start to see revenue? Is it mostly just consumer at first and, you know, super speed cell phones, or how quickly do you get into the advanced Internet of Things applications? What are your updated thoughts?
Yeah, we continue to think about it as a slow roll in terms of revenue growth. Certainly the initial stages of 5G are going to focus on the consumer front. We're already seeing that play out in the U.S. in terms of, you know, paying an additional, depending on the carrier, $10 a month for 5G, and we see it playing out somewhat similar in Canada. And that'll happen relatively early, and I think it'll be a good source of revenue growth for the industry. In the overall scheme of 5G, though, we continue to believe that's very much the the smaller portion of it. The bigger portion of it is going to come through the enterprise side and all the use cases that that 5G is going to enable. George, maybe you can spend a few minutes talking about some of those use cases brought on by 5G.
I mean, when we think about 5G, obviously this first phase of 5G, so in the next sort of 1 to 2 years, we will have essentially what is, they call the enhanced mobile broadband, so greater capacity, an evolution on 4G, if you will. In the next 3 to 5 years, we will see really a new set of capabilities entering into the market, namely low latency being one of those key ones, and edge computing, obviously, being a tool to enable that low latency application. We're already seeing some talk on edge computing, AWS talking about Outpost in terms of extending the AWS cloud out into the edge of the network. Google has recently announced Stadia, which is gaming in the cloud. Again, another application that will require low latency that will be out there. So, you know, you think about gaming console in the cloud, you really need sort of sub 10 millisecond latency. And the way to do that is essentially to deploy this capability right at the edge of the network. And of course, 5G will be a great application for that. And so obviously, the difference for us between how we monetize 4G in machine-to-machine today and as we think about 5G monetization, today you can think about 4G as a pipe that we provide connectivity into a central cloud, and the value that we extract from machine-to-machine is typically 5 to 10% of the total value chain. As we think about 5G and some of these use cases that I've described, you know, some of these web-scale guys will have to come to us. If they want to deploy a cloud application at the edge of the network, if they want us to provide a guaranteed latency, guaranteed bandwidth connection into a cloud, not only will they have to co-locate their cloud instance in our network, we also need to be able to provision that connectivity into their cloud application. So all of a sudden, the discussion and the negotiation required to do these deals is a very different conversation. We see ourselves increasing the level of sort of value share from the sort of 5, 10% up to the 25, 30% as we deploy these applications. And we will see more of these. You know, the various examples that are being talked about, one obviously V2X for autonomous vehicles. Again, another great example where if you can imagine a General Motors or a Tesla would do a deal with one of the web scales to deploy their vehicle-to-vehicle applications. Again, these guys will want guaranteed bandwidth, guaranteed latency, and we will be positioned to provide that at a national level.
Excellent. You mentioned the edge computing, and a lot of these services depend on putting the intelligence of the net right in the edge of the network. Does that impact your thoughts on network sharing at all? If you're just sharing radio access network with somebody, which you do in Quebec and other places, does it really save you much money if you have to go put your own core network at every mini cell site anyway?
Well, the network architecture, Vince, as you're saying, changes fundamentally, because today we have relatively defined central core nodes around the country. Typically, in Canada, we would have 6, 7 of these nodes. 5G extends the core of the network right out into the edge. So you need to have intelligence and capability almost at the cell level, but certainly at the cell site or certain aggregation cell sites, where we will have not only a core network, but also the intelligence and cloud computing. So you can imagine AWS Outpost instances riding right at the edge of our network. Now, if you think about it from a player such as Rogers that has a national network, we have the advantage to be able to negotiate these deals at the national level. Someone that is sharing a network, you can imagine having to have a very interesting conversation on negotiating how can I have my core network on the radio edge, and how would I negotiate a deal with an AWS or a Google or a Microsoft to provide that capability for me in the cell site of one of my competitors. It's just a more complex conversation to have that we don't have to worry about.
So is it fair to say network sharing is not higher on your priority list to extend or expand those types of deals?
Given my previous experiences with network sharing, no, they're not very high on my list.
Let me just package up the last question on wireless here, and then I'll open up to the floor if there's anything on wireless. So, Tony, we talked before, we talked about the volume, we talked about the ARPU. As you know, there's been some criticism from some of your peers of maybe what's going on in the mix of your subscribers. Tablets, prepaid to postpaid migration, whatever it is. But at the end of the day, doesn't matter what the components of it are, network revenue growth is clear for all investors to see. On that front, you're clearly better than the other incumbents in Q1 at 3.6%. But it is a deceleration. You did 4.8% in 2018. So when you package together what you said before in terms of volume and ARPU trends, is 4.8% from last year sort of a thing of the past, or is it possible to get back to that level of growth over, looking forward?
Yeah, so a couple things you've talked on. You know, the two things. As you think about revenue growth, it's subscriber share, which we're confident with our ability to not only get subscriber share, but subscriber share of quality loadings. We've talked about lifetime values. You know, in the first quarter of the loadings we did get, lifetime values were up over 10% year on year. So very happy with where that's going. One of our competitors recently started disclosing sort of the mix of their wireless subscribers. And if we were to look at things like tablets, you know, I can tell you that we sit at less than half of where they would sit on tablets. So I would say it really is a proof point for us that we have been focused on the smartphone category in terms of rich lifetime values and continuing to focus on that and improve those. So I think all the proof points are there in terms of where we're at. And then on the ARPU side, as you said, continuing to lead the industry in terms of ARPU growth, and I've just talked about how we see continued opportunity for moving that up as we progress through the year. So good prospects there. So overall for wireless revenue growth, you know, Q1 came in about 4%. For the rest of the year, we see it in and around 4%, so maybe a little bit less than we might have seen last year, but still very healthy growth in the overall scheme of things. And then when we combine that with a continued focus on cost efficiency and margin expansion, we continue to see very good prospects for cash flow growth for our wireless business.
Can you just, one other wireless question. Can you expand on the cost side of it? There's been some tremendous improvements in churn and the customer experience, especially in the past 2 years since Joe Natale's been there. Can you just talk about some of the key success factors of what you guys have done that's working better?
Yeah, absolutely. It, you know, it's been a, you know, if we were to look at 2017, 2018, proof point was, you know, over 200 basis points of margin expansion coming out of cost efficiencies. And I would say, first and foremost, and Joe's talked about this, making things simpler for the customer, getting things right the first time, not only gives a better customer experience, and you see that in our churn rate, in Q1 down to 0.99%, and as we look to Q2, we're kind of thinking churn levels at about the same. So it's a phenomenon that we see as sustainable, and that in and of itself is driving some pretty healthy cost efficiencies. Our first call resolution rates, if we were to compare to a year ago, those would be up in excess of 15% better year on year in terms of getting the customers problem resolved the first time. So we're seeing good things on that front. And I can go through a whole myriad of specific tactics that have been focused on customer experience improvements, all that have been laddering up to continued cost reductions.
No, I was just going to say, you don't need to list them all off, but I wanted you to throw in here just in a general way, because your time has, you know, predated Joe Natale and after. Is this list far more comprehensive and successful than maybe it had been before? Because I'm assuming Rogers' prior management didn't just ignore customer service, but is there something just better being done now than under this new
CEO?
I think
there's a couple of things. I would say the, ultimately it comes down to execution. And so it's about getting the right skill set that has experience in being able to do it at scale. It's about having the right measurement processes to make sure we're looking at the right metrics every day, every week, et cetera. And frankly, it's about having the right tools. And on that front, technology has just evolved in terms of AI and off-the-shelf analytics that are out there, more than you can actually use. And so part of the secret sauce is, which are the ones that are going to be most effective in tackling the problem? So all that to say is the number of things that go into it, but the overriding difference is it's a long-term, sustainable, methodical approach to it, as opposed to tactic to tactic.
Great. Any questions from the audience on wireless before we switch divisions? We have two questions. Three, look at this. You guys have stimulated this audience.
Well, one sort of broad-based, I've heard yourself and a couple other companies talk about this 89% versus 120, whatever that is in other countries. But then on the flip side, Teams Canada has very high pricing relative to other countries, although I think the association disputes that a little. So, you know, what's a realistic target, you know, compared to the U.S., given what I perceive to be a reasonable price differential, like as in lower prices down there?
Yeah, I think about it in terms of, you know, when you compare pricing to Canada and the U.S., it's kind of interesting. Look at ARPU under the new accounting standard. So one of the things that's been inflating ARPUs in Canada and the perception that somehow we are much higher than the U.S. Was the embedded subsidy in average ARPU. You take that out, you know, today we sit at, on postpaid, an average of $55 Canadian. Not that different than what you see in the U.S. in terms of average ARPUs. So I would say we're arguably somewhat in line in terms of how much the customer is willing to pay. In terms of what you get for that, I would say the U.S. has been a little bit ahead of the curve in encouraging more usage. And that's one thing that's a learning for us, and we see it as an opportunity. I talked about you know, our average user per subscriber, and I think there's opportunity there to move it up. And that moves what you would describe as the effective price per gig. But I think the industry is heading there. So all of that is working well. So I don't know that the Canada-U.S. differential is as big as we think it is. And we continue to move in the right direction. Ultimately, to your question, is it a prohibitor to the increase in penetration rates? I would say probably not. If you were to look at penetration rates, even take the last 4 to 5 years, they've moved tremendously over that period of time. And so all indices are that we should be tracking closely to where the U.S. is at.
Was there another question in the audience, I think? Yeah. The mic over here.
Yeah, I guess this is a wireless question, but just wondering if you could talk about the change in the free cash flow definition, specifically the adding back the increase in contract assets.
Yeah, for this year, in our definition of free cash flow, we sort of debated what we found in 2018 caused a bit of confusion in terms of being able to predict that contract asset management because it does fluctuate depending on the number of subscribers. So what we decided to do was simplify the free cash flow definition consistent with what some of the other players do, especially in the U.S., but still continue to provide that transparency on the contract asset management. And so in our disclosure for Q1, what you see is the simple free cash flow. We restated, gave you the numbers for last year, so it's clear year on year. And then separately, you can look at the contract asset management and come up with your assessment of the ups or downs, depending on subscriber loadings.
Is it fair to say, Tony, the free cash flow figure for guidance purposes, you've leaned towards something that's easier to predict, so you're not wildly off. But from a valuation perspective, you don't think anybody should ignore contract assets. Is that fair?
That's absolutely right. I mean, it really was something for simplicity for the audience. But overall, I can tell you we continue to focus on cash is cash at the end of the day, and it's all metrics that we're focused on internally.
Let's make sure we get time for the other parts of your business, so let me just shift to cable briefly. And George, while you're here, let me get your thoughts first. You know, we hear a lot from Bell and Telus about fiber and how great it is, and in their opinion, makes their network even better than what the cable companies provide on broadband. Can you talk about a little bit your perspective on the power of a cable network today and also some maybe technology developments on the horizon that you may be looking to deploy?
Sure. We have a very pragmatic view on the technology and how we use the technology. And essentially today the cable network provides 1 gigabit per second everywhere. Our cable network provides 1 gigabit per second. And we find that that is more than sufficient to serve our customer needs right now. We also work closely with cable labs in terms of the evolution of the cable technology. The specifications with cable labs are already there, complete for a 10 down, 10 up gigabit per second evolution. And over time, this technology will become available with chipsets and with the demand growth. We will see and we will continue to see the cable infrastructure evolve. The other point, and I think kind of leading to the kind of issue or rather the point of pragmatism, today where we have multi-dwelling units or new builds, we take fiber straight to the home. So essentially we use the technology that's available to us where we can have the most efficient capital deployment.
And on the, let's go ahead on the network and speed power side, how about in terms of the sort of features that you can use? I don't know if this is Tony or George who want to answer this. Leveraging the Comcast relationship, getting into more security and home automation type features that leverage the same broadband platform. Can you talk about some new developments you may be thinking about there?
Sure. Go ahead, George.
Do you want to go?
No.
Well, the great thing about the Comcast platform that we have right now is, starting, of course, with our Ignite platform, we have today what I would say is a fantastic aggregator of content, almost a curated access to OTT. I mean, it's something that we've embraced. We have, obviously, the linear TV offering, but we have, of course, Netflix. We'll have Amazon Prime. And as you see, some of the players, like Disney, recently announced retracting their content from Netflix and going on their own. We'll be able to offer that in time as well. So the Ignite platform is just this fantastic search engine that removes the complexity from our customers to have to, log into multiple applications. It's all there. The voice search facility is great and gives you, very quickly, the content across multiple platforms, whether they're in linear TV, video on demand, or any one of the other offerings that we have. So that's a great platform to start with. And then over time and over the coming months, we'll have xFi as well. So the in-home wall-to-wall Wi-Fi pods that we will launch. And then evolving that to xHome, which is a smart home connectivity. And again, there, the idea is really to make the life of the customer easy. We will have not only access to devices that Comcast is deploying, but another great thing that Comcast is doing and that we're working very closely with them is essentially bringing on board other ecosystems. So allowing the customer to choose whether it's a Google or an Amazon ecosystem, integrating that into the platform, and from an application, be able to manage any one of these devices. So the idea around the Ignite platform is an evolution over time, essentially removing the complexity from the customer and providing this sort of one-stop shop for everything that is video on demand all the way through to the smart home.
Excellent. You mentioned a bunch of sort of Comcast developments that you'll be able to take advantage of. One thing they've done is a skinny sort of TV service that's streaming only. They call Flex, very similar to Alt TV that Bell does here. It seems like Bell is getting some traction because they have that service and you don't. Is there some technology reason or regulatory reason that is slowing down you guys being able to do some sort of skinny service, or is it just a marketing decision that it's not the right time?
There's no technological reason why we can't do it. As part of our Comcast roadmap, it's a product available to us. As we've launched Ignite, our focus has been on that. As we said, as part of Ignite, what we really wanted to do was enter the market at the premium end. And that's what we did in phase one. Phase two was about then expanding it to the mid and lower tiers. That's what we've just done. As we ramp up volume significantly with Ignite TV. And then what you'll see us do in the fullness of time is then extend it to, what I would call the bottom end or Flex product, which is the Comcast product. And so, you know, without talking too much about some of our marketing plans, I would say we've thought about it in a phased approach that way, with a focus on not only total revenue, but ARPA. And so how do we do this in a measured way so we continue to see household ARPA being lifted with the Ignite TV product?
So stay tuned. Just not quite there yet. There's no reason you can't do it. I cannot pass up the opportunity when you have CTO and CFO on the stage to go to the CapEx question, which, as you know, one of the areas I've been maybe a bit critical of Rogers is your cable segment CapEx intensity is significantly higher than any of your Canadian peers and just in a totally different league versus what we see from the U.S. cable companies. You've promised to get down to 20 to 22% over time. Can you frame that for us a little bit? I'm not even quite sure myself. Is that supposed to be a three-year objective or a five-year objective? And is it sort of a steady line down at some point, or do we just stay at 35 and then just drop to 20 on 1 year?
Yeah, so we've said, as you said, we know what we have to do. And so our job is to get into, and I would describe it as a pretty significant first milestone, get into the 20 to 22% range. And then, you know, think about it beyond that. We said by the end of 2021, our exit rate would be to have a capital intensity ratio in the 20 to 22% range. We've also said we would see that decline happening more of a cliff in 2021 as opposed to a gradual decline. And the reason for that was we wanted to take the opportunity to take some of the cash we saved through CPE savings as well as product development and integration by following the Comcast roadmap and put that money into expanded node segmentation. Get the continuity of supply, get the better rates that affords when you can commit to longer-term infrastructure-type contracts. So that's what we have been doing. I'm pleased to say that things are going better than we expected on that. You saw in Q1 our capital intensity ratio come down to 29%. And that was driven by a number of things. The CPE unit pricing is coming in better than we expected. But importantly, much of that work on infrastructure in terms of fix and maintain and node segmentation, largely through the work that George and his team have been doing, is coming in at better pricing and cost efficiency than we had expected. So, George, I don't know if you want to spend a few minutes talking about that and how that's proceeding.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a huge focus as we look at the kind of the P times Q equation, looking at the price and the unit cost of technology. And, you know, this is down to a combination of things. On the one hand, just negotiating with our vendors and our total vendor strategy. That's mm-hmm. been part of the work that we've been doing. I kind of alluded to it when I talked about sort of a smart deployment, really making a very clear choice and deciding where and when and how we do node segmentation. That's done based on a demand and as congestion occurs. And then just looking at technology, you know, Ding technology has been evolving. You know, we've been, recruiting people that come from different industries that have gone through the sort of cost curve, and that have explored and have experience in deploying, you know, this technology just in a more efficient way. And so we're bringing new capability, new technology in terms of digging, micro trenching, using some of that. Capability that hasn't been used in the past before, and that lowers the cost, the unit cost, significantly.
So we expect for this year, Vince, maybe that's where you were going, was, you know, the 29% you saw in the first quarter, probably a continuation of where we're going to be this year. And so some of that reduction from where we were in 2018 is happening a little faster than we thought. So good news on the capital efficiency front, that you'll start to see results perhaps sooner than we had expected.
Good. I just, George, so the 20 to 22% exit rate in 2021, this is something you're on board with, too? It's not just something the CFO is telling you to do?
We're very much aligned with the message. Absolutely.
Good. As long as we hear it from both sides of the house, it's great. I don't want to spend too much time on media because it's small, but it was a pretty big outlier in your Q1 results in terms of EBITDA. Can you just clarify for us the sort of non-recurring, if I can call them, those items that impacted media, and clarify if there's any more of that non-recurring type stuff to come later in the year?
Yeah, as you said, Vince, media is small for us, you know, less than 5% of our valuation, but nonetheless important in terms of cash flow contribution for us as well. We had a couple of, when you looked at year-on-year growth rates, one-time items. In 2018, in the first quarter, we had received money from the MLB in terms of its sale of some of the MLBAM interest, and we saw that come in. We didn't have that this year. And then at the same time, there was a player contract trade that came with the write-off of the contract. And those combined were a $100 million impact in terms of year-on-year. They were one-time items, as you say. We don't expect anything going forward on the media front. The underlying fundamentals of media for this year, if you're to take that out, is revenue growth in the 3-4% range with EBITDA growth in approximately the same type of range. And so the underlying fundamentals for media, which are focused on sports, which continues to have healthy growth, as well as radio, which also continues to have not only a pretty solid, stable growth rate of 2-3%, but very strong cash flow margins that continue.
Great. I got a couple of corporate items to finish off with, but I want to pause again. Is there anything else in the audience at this point? Okay. So let's talk about assets, monetization for a second. I mean, you've talked about some things in the past, like corporate real estate and Cogeco shares. Is there any update on those fronts, especially as you face all these spectrum auctions and a need for cash, that there may be some consideration to monetizing some non-core assets?
A couple of things. I would phrase it as, you know, first little while with Joe coming on board as CEO, it's really focused on the operations, and that's where the biggest upside in shareholder value was going to come from. And that's what you've seen come through in the operations of each of our business units. We've had on our radar what I would describe as balance sheet efficiency and some of these other assets. And is there something we can do to maximize or surface the value associated with those assets? And I would say we continue to look at them, not so much from a need for cash. Our debt leverage sits comfortably at 2.7. As we look to the spectrum auctions over the next several years, with our forecasted generation of free cash flow, we don't see anything that is going to be a concern to us or the rating agencies. And so we have time to think about the best monetization or value creation for each of those assets. So we're going to be thoughtful about it. It hasn't fallen off the radar screen, but I have nothing to report new today.
Okay. You mentioned the free cash flow. One of the items in there, obviously, that bounces around is cash taxes. Some of your peers are having some significant catch-up items from prior, I think, limited partnership structures, the deferred tax. Can you first off just remind us where Rogers is on that curve? Is that some big nut that's coming in the future to have to catch up? And then secondly, the new tax rules on the deferred or accelerated depreciation. Are you starting to see that in your 2019 numbers, or is that in the future for Rogers?
Yeah, on those. No surprises on cash taxes, and so we don't have anything that's a one-time timing nature or anything like that. We have a different structure, and so we've talked about in the past, think about cash taxes as somewhere between 8-10% of EBITDA, our adjusted EBITDA. I think based on some of the things we've been doing, expect that number to be more in the 6-8% range of adjusted EBITDA. So that's coming nicely. In part, the lease accounting improves that ratio as well, just to be very transparent. In terms of the accelerated depreciation announcement that came out a little while ago, not much of that is going to impact this year. Very little. Think about it in the $20 million range. The big upside for us in terms of cash tax improvement, it'll happen starting in 2020. And again, think about it as a program that will have upside in cash taxes up till about 2025, 2026. And then depending on what improvements or changes happen to the tax law, some of that will slowly get eroded over time. So that's the profiling of that cash taxes.
I'm totally, just to clarify, the 6-8% range starts in 2019, even though you don't get too much of the new benefit yet?
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah. And last, you know, if cash taxes are going to not hurt your free cash flow. It sounds like everything on the EBITDA front is solid from your earlier comments. CapEx starts to come down. It sounds like the free cash flow growth picture is pretty strong, but yet Rogers, you're the only ones who won't really, of the big three, who won't really promise to dividend growth in the future. Can you frame that for investors? Does that mean you start off every year thinking we're not going to raise the dividend and we have to really have our arm twisted and to do it? Or is it just you don't want to promise it, but you're quite open to considering it if all the key free cash flow drivers you're talking about are heading in the right direction?
Yeah, I think we reiterate our position that first and foremost, we want to grow a company that is based on having the right fundamentals and the right fundamentals long term. It's not our character or our policy to try to look to satisfy one segment of the investment community with what I would describe as a guaranteed yield, irrespective of cash flow. I think we want the ability to do the right things and make the right decisions as we need to, and that correlate with business cycles. So what you've seen us do is occasionally, and it really is less of an annual cycle, and we think about it more agile in terms of use of cash. We just look at how are we doing in terms of cash flow, what are our projections, where are we in investment cycles, and you know, you saw us put more money into some infrastructure. We think it's the right time to do it in terms of where interest rates are at. So take opportunity, given we have the cash flow to not only do that, but return cash to shareholders, which we continue to do through dividends. We thought doing what we did was the right amount and the right time, and we augmented that with share buybacks. We've said to the extent that cash flow continues to go the way it has been of late, then we will index more towards share buybacks, generally because it gives us more flexibility than a long-term dividend commitment.
Wonderful. We'll end it there. Tony, George, thank you very much for your time and your insights.
Thank you.
So we'll take a 15-minute break and then reconvene.